Wouldn't you love to get paid for doing what you love to do? If you're ready to move on to what's next, join us for Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson. Our uplifting live talk show on Saturday mornings from 10 to noon will have you circling back, not running in circles, to pull your experience forward in new ways. Advance your career, plus help others with theirs. Join us Saturdays, 10 to noon, right here on 104.1 The Truth, for pragmatic advice and unconventional wisdom. Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, where your path is created by walking on it. Good morning again here on Circles of Change. A real pleasure for me to connect with an internationally well-known best-selling author, Mr. Richard Paul Evans in Salt Lake City. Good morning. How are you today, Richard?
I'm good. I'm a whole lot colder than you are.
Well, that's okay. You'd be surprised. We had 28 degrees here in Tucson. So, but we're not going to, we never do the weather check from here. It's just not a healthy way to start. Well, happy holidays, sir. And thank you so much for enjoying and the opportunity to join us. Let me give a brief introduction. Richard Paul Evans, he's a number one best-selling author of multiple books on the New York Times bestseller list. In fact, over 20 novels. The one that I first recalled was The Christmas Box, which by no means was his first novel. These books have netted now over 17 million copies in print in 24 languages they've been translated to, and then in their own right, international bestsellers in those locations. Richard is the winner of multiple awards, the winner of the American Mother's Book Award, Romantic Times, awards in Germany, Washington Times, and so on. It's a wonderful repertoire of expertise. It was over a decade ago that he was asked to give an impromptu talk to a group of students in Ohio, and the end result has been a presentation, a talk he's given in multitude of venues, and we're going to hear about that because it's now in the context of really a rare opportunity. He's released his first nonfiction book. It's called The Four Doors, and it's filled with inspiring stories that include stories that his readers told him, stories of great achievers who overcame hardships, the story actually of his own struggle growing up in a large family with financial difficulties. So, Richard, you know, as I know, speaking with many authors, it's one thing to write novels. It's quite a different experience to open up your soul, although you're quite a soulful individual, I can tell from the way you wrote your novels, to actually tell your own story. So was the writing of this book thus a different journey than your novels?
You know, it's really cathartic to share your own story. And in some ways, in each of my novels, I am sharing myself.
Sure, yeah.
So it wasn't necessarily that off. I remember in one of my novels, The Gift, I had one of the characters have Tourette's syndrome, and I have Tourette's syndrome.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it was the first time I had addressed it, and it turned out to be a wonderful thing. It turned out to be the thing that the press wanted to talk about in all my interviews. But it really hit a chord with all those parents of children with Tourette's syndrome around the country.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Well, take our listeners back, because I've of course enjoyed the pleasure of reading your book. So I read the preamble about your being invited to go address what you thought was going to be a small group of students. But what happened?
Well, I was going to thank some students for a donation they had made to my charity. We help abused children. And so when I got there, unprepared, the teacher who invited me ran out very excited. She said, "Our district supervisor was so excited, we made a district-wide assembly. You have an hour." And so here I am walking into this auditorium, not prepared at all. And fortunately, I like to speak. And so
that's right.
I'm looking at these kids and think, but I'm not prepared. It's like, what am I going to say to them? And then it hit me, tell them everything you wish you knew when you were their age.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened over the next hour was really magical. When you open yourself up to the spirit like that, when you open yourself up to that force that sometimes comes to me as I'm writing my books, the kids were spellbound. They just sat there in complete silence. And then I noticed that about a third of the audience was actually crying. And when I finished, they gave me a standing ovation. And then the kids came up, just rushed the stage. And I remember the first girl said, "Would you please hug me?"
Oh, is that
wonderful?
And
I thought, something really powerful has just happened here. I realized that this is something the world needed. So I began giving this talk, and I just called it The Talk for years. And word of it just spread. And I was actually flown by Bain Capital to Portugal to give it to the Harvard MBA graduates who they had just brought out.
Mm-hmm.
I've given it in prison to hardcore felons, and I've seen the effect of these words on just pretty much kind of every level of life.
And so, and I think if I recall, it's been like 10 years you've been giving this talk.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yeah, more than 100,000 people.
100,000 people. So why now? Why now did you decide to put it into a book?
It just kind of came together. After every presentation over the last 10 years, imagine how tiring this would get. People would say, where do I get the book?
Okay, yeah, that's right.
Or where do I get this? Every presentation, so hundreds of presentations, and I'd have to say, I don't have one. It's like, I would have recorded it. I want my son to hear this. I want my husband to hear this. And so I knew that the time would come. And it just worked out this year. I had such a busy writing schedule. Right now I'm doing 3 books a year, and so I have 2 series, The Walk and Michael Vay.
Mm-hmm.
And I just finished the Michael Vay series. I was behind on my books, and it's like, you know what? I have this window here. I'm going to write it. And that's what I did. So I wrote The Four Doors, and I really didn't know how it would do because it's so different. I got a lot of complaints from my readers who like my novels at Christmas time, but the book did hit the New York Times bestseller list right off. So, and I've heard from especially a lot of counselors and people over youth buying stacks of books.
Well, that's it. You like it to get to become required reading. I like that one. Exactly. Any author's dream, that's for sure. Well, Richard, please explain what those doors are to our listeners.
The first door is to believe there's a reason you were born. People ask me what I read as a novelist, and the truth is I don't read novels. They usually bore me. I read nonfiction and mostly biographies.
Yeah.
And I've read biographies from George Washington to Charlemagne to Steve Jobs. I've studied the lives of more than 200 people. And somewhere along my studies, I start looking for the commonality. What is it that these people have that made them different? What gave them the power to change the world when most people struggle to change their homes?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And it hit me when I was reading a book on George Washington. I read something and I thought, I've seen that before. And I start going back and I realized that that what they all had in common, the only thing they had in common, in total, was that they had a belief that they were here.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's what drives us. And if you don't have that belief, you will never achieve greatness. You just won't. It won't happen.
And I recall also in your book, as you revealed your own life story, that, and I don't think this is uncommon for some people, some can actually come to that understanding themselves, and others need it pointed to them, and that your grandfather did that for you.
My grandfather gave me a blessing when I was 12 years old. He laid his hands on my head, and his blessing, he said I would someday be known throughout the world and walk with the royalty of this earth. And it struck me when I was in Dallas, Texas, I was in Houston, and I just had lunch at the home of George and Barbara Bush, and then their son, who George W., who was the president at the time, he came, and British Prime Minister John Major was there. And I'm sitting here with 2 U.S. presidents,
my goodness,
British Prime
yes.
Minister. It's like, it happened. This is what my grandfather said would happen when I was 12 years old.
But to be gifted that, or actually to some of us might be frightened by that. I mean, actually, I think more people are afraid of success than they are of failure these days.
Well, that's one of the doors.
That's one of the doors, yes.
The second door is to free yourself from limitation.
Yeah.
And there's really 3 cages that stop most of humanity. The first is paradigm, the second is fear, and the third is the acceptance of victimhood. And the fear you talk about is exactly right. There's more, the greatest shackles we wear in this life are those forged by our own fears. And that's what stops most people. And it's sad because, you know, there's really wonderful things out there. I'm so grateful for the risks I've taken in my life and the fears I've overcome. Speaking of Texas, I remember when I self-published my first book, The Christmas Box, I was afraid. Mm-hmm. I was afraid of flying in airports and all that. I mean, I remember I got to Dallas and I had never rented a car before. Mm-hmm. I was actually afraid. It sounds so ridiculous to me now. I've flown almost 2 million miles, and I mean, I know every airport in America, and And now it seems silly, but I was afraid back then. How grateful I am that I overcame those, you know, living small and getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the whole idea of getting away from living small, but living much bigger. You might want to explain your very first insidious cage, like you referred to it, and that being the one of paradigm. This idea of what we've brought with us or what we drag along with us.
Right. Paradigm is an insidious cage, as you said, because it's most people don't know they're in it.
Mm-hmm, right.
The paradigm is this box that's around us that we accept the reality we're in. Oh, we're just poor, or we just live in a slum, or we're just unhealthy people.
Or I have a crummy boss.
Yeah. Or I have a bad job, and I'll... I'm uneducated. You know, it's just accepting this, and the key to overcoming paradigm is, first of all, recognizing that you're trapped in a paradigm, that everything around you is a box, and that you can go beyond it. And I'm amazed when you see someone who's accomplished and famous, and you think, you know, they came from a little paradigm, they came from a little city somewhere. And the best example is if you go along. I think it's Route, I want to say 36 in northern Missouri. There's nothing there. There's just tiny little towns, and yet along this one route of highway, there's a home of J.C. Penney and General John Pershing, the highest ranking mm-hmm. military officer in history, and Walt Disney, and Otto Rohwedder, the inventor of sliced bread, and Mark Twain.
All in the same slice of highway.
On the same little highway. And it's like there's nothing there. They broke beyond the paradigm of where they were, these tiny, tiny little towns. And they did this through imagination. And that's why imagination, as Einstein said, is more important than knowledge. Because imagination takes us beyond the known. It takes us into realms of production and to beauties that we don't know otherwise. And so people need to start using their imaginations again, and they need to apply it to their lives.
Well, this third element, though, paradigm, fear, and the third one, the acceptance of victimhood, boy, is that a trap that we see people stuck in, don't we?
Yes. Whenever I mention this in the audience, people start nodding their heads. Everyone knows someone who lives life as a victim. Oh, no, I can't do that because this happened to me. Victimhood, the attitude of victimhood is using past hurts and injustices as currency to buy out of present living.
Exactly, yeah.
And this is a huge mistake for two reasons. First of all, you are taking the greatest gifts you have, your free will and your own power, and you're giving it away. You're giving it to, you're assigning it to some other external event or some other person. The other reason is that it ignores the truth that most of our greatest blessings come wrapped as adversity.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, if we just, you know, I look back in my life and the most difficult things I've been through are what taught me the most and made me better.
And certainly gave you the opportunity to coach and guide others through it. We're speaking with Richard Paul Evans, and his newest book is The Four Doors, A Guide to Joy, Freedom, and Meaningful Life. We've talked about the first two. Number one, believe there's a reason you were born. And number two, free yourself from limitations. So door number three.
Door number three is magnify your life. Mm-hmm. And this is exciting to me. The idea of magnifying your life to make it bigger, to make it as big as your potential allows. I'm not talking about being Lady Gaga. this is about magnifying your joy and your influence for good. This is a beautiful thing. And once you have broken free from those fears and the limitations of the second door, magnifying your life is a very natural thing, but it takes action. And so there's two parts of magnifying your life. The first is to dream again.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, as a novelist, sometimes, you know, when we're teaching creative writing courses, they use an exercise called the what if. And they ask the what if question. You know, what if a young woman moves to a small town, falls in love with a boy, and finds out he's a vampire? You know, Twilight. Well, this works not just in novels, it works in life.
Yeah, right.
One time my wife came to me and said, what if we moved to Italy? Like, we moved to Italy? I've never even been to Italy. It's like, yeah, what if? And the beauty of the what if question is that we've all learned to shut down our dreams. We've all learned to stop ourselves. The what if is a safe way to kind of test the waters. And the next thing I know, we're flying to Italy to look at schools for our kids, and we ended up moving to Florence, Italy for almost 2 years. What came from that experience was magical. Our family got so close. Not only do we have dinner every night together for 2 years,
that's right,
but I spent at least 3 hours a day talking to my kids, because I drove them to schools in different cities.
Sure.
And we got so close. There's a bond there that will never go away. Mm-hmm. And especially my oldest daughter, who is about to graduate from high school. What a beautiful way to end that time, to spend that much time together. It also, my marriage just exploded in a wonderful way. It became more romantic and fun. And Carrie and I got so close. That what if was opened a beautiful possibility for us. And so for people to ask themselves, what if I opened that bakery I always wanted to open? Mm-hmm. What if I lost that weight? But not just that, what if I became a competitive cyclist? What if I wrote the book I've been talking about for the last 20 years? You know, to just start playing that what if and not die with regrets. So that's the beginning of magnifying your life. Then the second is to take risk, riskful action. And this is really where courage comes in. And it's amazing that in most cases we take riskful action and we've imagined these horrible things are going to happen instead of imagining wonderful things that are going to happen.
Exactly. We do what if negative instead of what if positive.
And I don't know why we do that. I guess it's our fears. But I'm just surprised at how often that things really aren't as hard as we think they're going to be,
particularly,
or how much is waiting.
Isn't that true? Particularly when you get hindsight. So believe there's a reason you were born. Free yourself from limitation. Magnify your life and embrace that risk of being. And then the final one, which really pulls it all together.
That's right. It's to create a love-centered map. I started the book out by talking about why we believe what we believe and how we believe. That we begin creating maps, and all of our maps, there's two important things to understand about maps. First of all, the map is not the road. The maps we have in our head that we believe is reality really isn't reality, which is why two people can look at the same thing and see something completely different. I can look at an American flag and feel devotion and feel gratitude. Someone from a different ideology can look at an American flag and feel hatred and anger. It's because our maps are different. So the map is not the road. Second, all of our maps, to some degree, are flawed. They were given to us at a young age. We have built them on false assumptions and bad knowledge. And so when we understand these things, we understand that we're navigating off these maps. The important thing is that we're constantly correcting our maps. And our maps can be centralized. They can have certain courses. You've met people who have maps that are based completely on their religion or their church.
Sure, exactly.
As opposed to having a map centered on God, which it's not the same thing.
Or you have people whose maps are actually, they don't even have one. The metaphor, the GPS, they need the voice to yell at them and tell them to turn right, turn left, or stop.
Yeah, a map based on nothing.
Nothing. direction from others, constant direction from others.
Exactly. Or a map, yes, that's right. A map, you know, still based on the childhood map. Or a map that's based on greed or sex or any of these things can take over our maps. The most powerful map there is a map based on love. That we're coming at life from the highest aspiration of humanity, which is love. And to say, okay, and this is actually a very powerful way to live life, not a weak way, not a withering way. It's actually very powerful. But it opens up our hearts and our lives to tremendous joy and accomplishment. So that's to me, is the most important of all the doors, because once we understand that our maps can be centered and focused on love, it drives out fear. It drives out victimhood. It actually takes care of the limitations and it becomes the reason. So it kind of takes care of the other three doors.
Mm-hmm, exactly. We're speaking with Richard Paul Evans, by the way, in his book, The Four Doors, A Guide to Joy, Freedom, and Meaningful Life. You can learn more about Richard's wonderful literary career, his speaking engagements, his counseling and working with others at richardpaulevans.com. So tell me something. How is it you think you've changed the most by helping others change, Richard?
That's a good question. Yesterday was an amazing day for me because it's December 6th. December 6th is where we commemorate those who have lost children at our Christmas Box Angel statues. Mm-hmm. There's more than 120 of these monuments around the world, and tens of thousands of people gather at them. And so last night I was there with people, and I think I've become in some ways softer.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've become less judgmental. I just see what people carry. A couple came up to me last night, and they had a picture of their 13-year-old son who had died this year. And then I found out that he had been bullied so bad that he committed suicide. And it's just so heartbreaking. Another couple came up and told me that their son-in-law had shot their grandson in the head with a gun and then killed himself. And it's just the pain that people go through. And we're out in the streets with them, and we get angry because they cut us off or they seem impatient. Mm, it's like instead of saying they're carrying more
something,
than you
exactly.
understand,
exactly.
more than you know at least.
Well, Richard, your variety of books, and you know, as we mentioned earlier, over 20 novels, and now this nonfiction piece. I know we're kind of early in the market to see the reaction, but I suspect you're getting just as much resounding applause, literally and figuratively, for this piece as you did your prior ones. Even though it's early, do you feel that coming your way?
What I see is, I feel like it was like the Christmas box that it was building its own following.
Yes.
Because when I release a novel, it immediately just kind of explodes on the bestsellers lists, and because I have all these, you know, followers, hundreds of thousands of followers, and when I came out with this, it's like, what's this?
Yep. Right.
Know, like, I came out with a cookbook or something.
Right.
It's like, do we trust him with this? And so I had enough of my readers who, you know, bought it to put on the bestseller list. But what I'm finding is that I'm having people come who don't come to my signings.
Yeah,
I was at one signing. I was a signing actually in Ohio where that all started. And I had a larger black audience than I've ever had. And none of them had met me before.
Mm-hmm.
And one man came up to me and I said, well, how did you hear about this? He said, I was driving home and the spirit told me to come find you.
Oh, my word.
He said, I never heard of you. I didn't know who you were. He said, go to the store. I went there and I saw your picture and it's like, you need to hear that man. And he was a pastor over a group of youth. Of troubled youth, and he goes, I need your book for them, and I had Mennonite women there. It was such a diverse crowd. It's like, and I asked the audience, how many of you have never seen me before? And more than half of the hands,
mm-hmm.
More than 100 people there had never heard of me. This is really cool because it's drawing a different audience than what I usually have.
Yeah, that's a wonderful opportunity. And so, you know, taking this body of work, both through how you've alliterated it through your novels as well as now your own story, to pulling additional people in. Well, with all the audiences you've addressed over the time, which one brings back a memory that absolutely stopped you in your tracks?
Oh, I love that question. I walked into a school to speak, and they didn't tell me what kind of school it was, that it was just short of prison.
Mm.
And I walked into a group of youth who had so much hate, who they were so angry. And I walked in and you could feel their hatred for me, you know, rich white guy.
Mm.
And it was stunning. And the thing was, it didn't intimidate me at all because of that fourth door. I looked at these kids with tremendous love. And, you know, I've spoken to in prison and I know the impact of these words. And they were threatened to be punished if they didn't listen, and most of the kids had put their earbuds in as a sign of defiance. I said, you don't need to listen, and no, you're not going to get punished. I said, but I think I have something that you're going to want to hear. And by the end, all of them were leaning forward. They were talking to each other. They were, some of them were crying, and two of the kids came up and asked if they could hug me and thank me. And I remember one came up and he said, I've never told anyone this before, but I want to be a neurosurgeon.
Oh, don't you love it? Well, Richard, what a great place to start. Richard Paul Evans, The Four Doors, thanks for joining us here on Circles of Change. And have a great holiday, Richard.
Thank you. You too.
Take care.
Change is chaotic. That is, unless you embrace it, going places you hadn't dreamed were possible. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, is a leadership consulting, executive coaching, and career transition firm. We help individuals make the most of their current employment situation or to step forward confidently into a career transition. Contact us at thelarsongroup.com or toll free 1-877-544-2580. The Larson Group, Architects of Change, 877-544-2580.